We're continuing through Bible surveys. You're getting a basic freshman Bible college class overview of the entire Bible. We're doing about a book per Wednesday. Last week we were in the book of Judges, which is a dark, depressing book. It kind of shows how things turn out when people live however they please. And it started with, the verse that kind of sums it up is Judges 21, 25, that says, "In those days, Israel had no king, and everyone did as they saw fit," or "everyone did what was right in their own eyes," is another way to translate that. Today, we're in a much less depressing book. We're in the book of Ruth. Now, the book of Ruth takes place during the same time as the book of Judges. It probably takes place towards the end of that time period, which would put it in the late 1100s BC, most likely. That's just an educated guess based on the genealogy that we find in chapter 4. Unfortunately, as with most genealogies, there are skipped generations, so we don't know for sure. But I am assuming that the skipped generations come before Boaz rather than after him. So that places this, like I said, in the late 1100s BC. That would place them in that time when even Israel's good judges are not very godly. If you remember last week, we had the judge cycle where Israel goes through this kind of downward spiral where they have kind of obedience for a while. They fall into apostasy and idolatry. God brings about some sort of oppression upon them. They eventually kind of sort of repent and cry for help. God raises up a judge who delivers them, and then they do it all over again. And each time they repent a little less and fall a little bit farther, and it's kind of a downward spiral. So Ruth is probably, and the other people in our story are probably living in that, towards the end of that downward spiral. So this is not good days in Israel. But this story, which is really a love story, stands out as an example of faithfulness and love, even when society in general is wallowing in complete moral filth. It's a story about Naomi's grief and recovery. It's a story about Ruth's kindness, faithfulness, and love. It's a story about Boaz's goodness and godliness. And ultimately, it's the story about how God is faithful and directs all events. So the story starts in chapter 1 with a family, well, as everyone did in the time of Judges, doing what's right in their own eyes. There's a famine in the land, and a man named Elimelech, moves his family, which is his wife Naomi, and his sons Mahlon and Chilion, from Bethlehem, where they are from, to the neighboring nation of Moab. Now, Israel was not supposed to associate with Moab. Moab was kind of a cousin nation. They're the descendants of Lot and one of his daughters, that story. And they have been forbidden to associate with this nation. Back in Deuteronomy 23, verses 3 through 6, says, "No Ammonite or Moabite or any of their descendants may enter the assembly of the Lord, not even in the tenth generation, for they did not come to meet you with bread and water on your way when you came out of Egypt. And they hired Balaam, son of Beor, from Pethor and Aram," wow, lots of names, "Naharaim, to pronounce a curse on you. However, the Lord your God would not listen to Balaam, but turned the curses into a blessing for you, because the Lord your God loves you. Do not seek a treaty of friendship with them as long as you live." So this is a nation that Israel isn't supposed to have anything to do with. They withstood Israel when Israel was trying to come into the land. They hired Balaam to try and curse them, which is a hilarious story that has a talking donkey in it. Go back and read it if you never have. On top of that, they are idolaters who worship the god Chemosh. And Chemosh was known, among other things, for at least sometimes requiring human sacrifice. He is one of the nastier gods in that part of the world. And so for Elimelech and his family, fleeing to Moab seems like the good course of action. There's no food in Israel, but there's food in Moab, so they're going to go to Moab. And by the way, the fact that there's no food in Israel might indicate that we're at the bottom of that judge cycle. Israel might be in one of those sections of oppression as a punishment for apostasy. But they flee to Moab, where they have no business being. Shortly after they get there, Elimelech dies. And then his sons marry Moabite women named Ruth and Orpah. And trivia bit that has nothing to do with anything. Oprah Winfrey, her name was supposed to be Orpah, but her mother's midwife was less than literate and spelled it wrong. But anyway. So there's your worthless trivia for the night.
Didn't know that.
But anyway, Mahlon and Chilion marry Ruth and Orpah, which they had, again, no business doing. It's one of those things that might have seemed like a good idea at a time. We're here in Moab. Moab has food, so we might as well settle down and have a family, even though they're supposed to be in no way associated with the Moabites, let alone marrying Moabite women. But again, this is the days of Judges, so everyone does what's right in their own eyes, and they do it. About 10 years later, Mahlon and Chilion die as well, widowing Naomi, Ruth, and Orpah. Now, they're all widows living in Moab. Naomi hears that God has ended the famine in Israel. We might even be, you know, that deliverance phase of the judge cycle at this point. And she decides to return. And as she's going back, she tries to send her daughters-in-law back to their own people and their own gods. At this point, Naomi is allowing her grief to cloud her judgment a bit. She is telling her daughter-in-laws to go back and resume being Chemosh worshipers. Not a main application from the book of Ruth, but something that we can pull from this is that we shouldn't ever become so wrapped up in grief and our own problems that we turn other people away from God. Whether it's actively, like Naomi is doing here, or just by being such a depressed, hopeless person that people look at you and go, why would I want what you have? But Naomi's pretty wrapped up in her grief. And she tries to send her daughter-in-laws back. Orpah returns to her people. But Ruth, who's the hero of our story, at this point begins demonstrating her faith and her character. Ruth chapter 2, verses 16 and 17 is Ruth's reply. And this is after Naomi has tried to send her away at least three times. It says, but Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and where there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. So Ruth willingly accepts the God and people of Israel as her own God and people. Like Rahab from back in the book of Joshua, she becomes a worshiper of the Lord. She becomes a convert. And there are passages in the Old Testament that talk about God's acceptance of such people. People who are on the outside, are part of a cursed nation, or at least a pagan nation, who wholeheartedly convert and turn to God are acceptable to him, just as at any time in history, those who respond in faith to the Lord are accepted. And if you want an example of a reference that talks about this, over in the book of Isaiah, chapter 56, Isaiah 56 and starting in verse 3, it says, let no foreigner who is bound to the Lord say, the Lord will surely exclude me from his people. And then it goes on and talks a while about eunuchs, but then picking back up in verse 6, it says, and foreigners who bind themselves to the Lord to minister to him, to love the name of the Lord and to be his servants, all who keep the Sabbath without desecrating it and who hold fast to my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain and give them joy in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and sacrifices will be acceptable on my altar, for my house will be called the house of prayer for all nations. You might recognize that last bit of something that Jesus quotes when he kicks the money changers out of the temple. But God has made it clear through history that he accepts those who come to him in faith. And at this era in history, when Ruth is living, that means becoming a worshiper of the one true God and joining the people of Israel, who are God's chosen people. Ruth does that. And, you know, true love for God is demonstrated by love for others. Those two greatest commandments of love God with all that you are and love your neighbor as yourself are inextricably linked. You can't have one without the other. And Ruth has declared her love for God and also her kindness and love for Naomi. Naomi is too old to work. She has no immediate family members to support her. So Ruth steps up, even though it's not really her responsibility, especially since Naomi has told her, just go back to your people. But, you know, true biblical love looks out for the good of others, especially when it requires self-sacrifice. And Ruth says, nope, I'm going with you. I am now a worshiper of your God. I am going to join your people, Israel. I am going to take care of you till the day you die. Nothing is going to separate us. I am taking responsibility for your welfare. Excuse me. Well, Naomi arrives back in Bethlehem, a very broken woman, and she's lost her husband and both of her sons. And she no longer wants to be called Naomi. The name Naomi means pleasant, but instead she wants to change her name to Mara, which means bitter. And she's not saying that she has bitter feelings towards God, but she's saying that he has filled her life with bitter things, with things that bring grief into her life. And she emphasizes that God is the ultimate cause of everything that's happened to her, maybe even recognizing it as his punishment for the sinful lifestyle that she and her family chose to adopt by going and living in Moab. But and Naomi is still so wrapped up in her grief that she's fairly calloused towards Ruth, even. At one point she says, "The Lord has brought me back empty." I picture poor Ruth. "Well, thanks, Mom. I'm here." But anyway, in chapter 2, Ruth volunteers to go out and get food for them. And the Jewish welfare system, if you want to call it that, allowed for the poor to get food by going and working in the fields. If you had a grain field, you weren't allowed to reap all the way to the corners of it. And anything that you happened to drop while you were threshing, you had to leave on the ground for the poor people to pick up. This was all incorporated in the Old Testament law because God has always cared about providing for the poor. Apparently he views giving them good work as a better option than giving pure handouts. But whatever the case, Ruth decides to go out and do this. And from this point on in the story, Naomi starts taking more of an interest in what's going on and helping guide and instruct Ruth, who is very new to this culture. She comes from a completely different country, and now she's learning the customs of Israel. And at this point, as Ruth goes out to try and gather some grain for them, she just so happens, anytime something just so happens in the Bible, you can make gods behind it. I mean, my favorite story is Esther, which is just full of coincidences, but you know, we'll get to that when we get to that. But coincidentally, she happens to end up in the field of a very godly man named Boaz. And as we look down through chapter 2, we see a lot of godly traits in this man, even though, again, this is in the dark days of the Judges. There aren't too many good people around. But verse 4, it says, "Just then Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. 'The Lord be with you, and the Lord bless you,' they answered." So Boaz and his workers, those who are with him, the Lord is an everyday part of their life. They haven't completely forsaken him as many others have. And he notices Ruth. He asks about her. And then he makes sure that Ruth, who is very much an outsider, she's not going to be very well liked because she's a Moabite. And remember, you're not really supposed to associate with Moabites. He makes sure that she is treated well. Verses 8 and 9. It says, "So Boaz said to Ruth, 'My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here with the women who work for me. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the women. I've told the men not to lay a hand on you. Whenever you're thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars that the men have filled.'" So he makes sure that she's treated well. He makes sure that his own workers aren't going to bother Ruth. And in fact, he, as he continues to talk to her, he recognizes and praises Ruth for her kindness, for her love, for her faith in God even. Verses 11 and 12, says, "Boaz replied, 'I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge.'" So he recognizes and praises Ruth's own kindness, love, faith. And throughout the day, he then makes sure that she has far more than is necessary. But he does it in a way that's fairly, as inconspicuous as possible. Verses 14 through 17. It says, "At mealtime, Boaz said to her, 'Come over here, have some bread, and dip it in the wine vinegar.' When she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. She ate all she wanted and had some left over." Which, by the way, that wasn't how you usually treated the poor people gleaning in your field. But Ruth, as a foreigner, probably didn't realize it. And she got up to glean. Boaz gave orders to his men, "Let her gather among the sheaves and don't reprimand her. Even pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up, and don't rebuke her." Exactly. So Boaz tells his people, yeah, drop a little extra. Because, you know, once you drop something, you're not allowed to pick it back up. So, oops, I dropped a whole handful here. I can just see the workers giving each other looks as Boaz is giving them these instructions, right? So he makes sure that Ruth has above and beyond what a poor person would usually have working in a field. In fact, by the end of the day, she has about 30 pounds of grain, which I don't know what the average is, but it was probably a whole lot less than that. And she gets home and shows Naomi how much she collected. And Naomi is shocked and very excited. And as she's talking and finds out whose field this came from, she realizes something about Boaz. Verse 20, "The Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. "He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead." She added, "That man is our close relative. He is one of our guardian redeemers." In their society, Boaz has the kinship role of guardian redeemer, also called kinsman redeemer. Now, to redeem means to buy something back. In Israel, land was not supposed to be permanently sold outside of the family. Land was supposed to be kept within the family. If someone lost possession of their land, either through becoming poor or dying and it being sold off, a near relative was supposed to buy it back. The laws for that, if you want to read them later, are in Leviticus 25 through the end of the chapter. It's a big, long section. And on top of that, if a man died without children, his brother, or at least his next closest relative, was supposed to marry his widow, and the first child born would then be considered an heir of the one who had died and inherit that property. And, you know, any other children would be considered heirs of the younger brother or other brother. And if you want, again, if you want to look that up later, some of the laws governing that are in Deuteronomy 25, 5 through 10. And again, coincidentally, this is the field that Ruth has ended up in. God is at work behind the scenes bringing these two together. And Naomi recognizes the Lord's goodness in what is going on. Throughout the whole book, Naomi points out many times that everything that happens, both the sad things like losing her first husband and sons, and the great things like Ruth just happening to end up in Boaz's field, are from the Lord. Well, chapter 3, Ruth goes and Ruth proposes to Boaz, is basically what happens. Naomi tells her all the proper customs to observe, and Ruth goes in verses, verses 7 and 8. It's harvest time. They take the field to the threshing floor. That night everyone sleeps out there with the grain to protect it. After all, this is the dark days of the judges. You don't want people coming by and stealing it. And so Ruth, following the instructions of Naomi, who teaches her and helps her navigate Jewish culture, says that when Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man. He turned, and there was a woman lying at his feet. Uncovering his feet apparently was a ceremonial gesture of the time and also a convenient way to wake someone up when it's cold outside. So he wakes up, and there's Ruth. Like I said, Ruth basically proposes to him in verse 9. "Who are you?" he asked. "I'm your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family." And Ruth here is, I believe, intentionally mirroring the wording of her first conversation with Boaz, and it doesn't show up real well in an English translation. But when she talks about spreading the corner of your garment over me, the corner of a garment is the exact same word in the original language as when Boaz talks about Ruth coming under the wings of God to take refuge. So Ruth, going back to the original conversation, proposes to Boaz, asks him to marry her, asks him to be the guardian redeemer of the family. And Boaz's response continues to show his good character. Verses 10 and 11. First of all, he accepts her. "Does the Lord bless you, my daughter?" he replied. "This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all that you ask. All the people of my town know that you are a woman of noble character." So he agrees to marry her, but there's one thing standing in the way. And that is the fact that there is someone else who has a closer blood relative, so has first rights to redeeming the land and marrying Ruth. Verses 12 through 14. "So although it is true that I'm a guardian redeemer of our family, there is another who is more closely related than I. Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to do his duty as your guardian redeemer, good, let him redeem you. But if he is not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. Lie here until morning." So she lay his feet until morning, but got up before anyone could be recognized, and said, "No one must know that a woman came to the threshing floor." So Boaz recognizes her love, recognizes her for her kindness and her goodness and her godly character, and he doesn't take advantage of her. He looks after both her safety and her reputation. He has her stay at the threshing floor while it's night, because it's unsafe to be out on the roads after dark during this time in history. But he also has her leave before anyone recognizes her and starts nasty gossip. And he's going to make sure that everything is done legally. He obviously is very much attracted to Ruth. He obviously loves her. The fact that he knows right off the top of his head that there's someone else who is closer means that he's been thinking about this. But he is going to do what is right, even if it could mean that he loses something that would be dear to him. He is going to follow the law the way it is supposed to be followed and make sure that this other man doesn't want to function as guardian redeemer first. Well, chapter 4, the other man at first is very excited at the opportunity to buy the land. I mean, he gets to increase his holdings. And he says, "Yes, I'll do it." And Boaz says, "Oh, by the way, you also have to marry Ruth." Then he's not so excited about it, because then he recognizes that the firstborn son would be considered either Mahlon or Chilion, whichever one that was married to Ruth, considered that his heir, and he would inherit all that land. And he doesn't much want to marry Ruth anyway. And so he passes on the opportunity. And strangely enough, to seal the deal, he gives Boaz his shoe, which is probably, it seems very strange. It's probably symbolic of the fact that Boaz now has the right to walk on this land. Apparently it was a custom for when there were land deals. So Boaz is now able to marry Ruth. Ruth and Boaz get married. They have a son. Before that, the elders of the town serve as witnesses and also pronounce their blessing on Boaz and Ruth. You can tell from the warmth in it that they are both very well-loved people. They're both people that are looked up to and respected. Verses 11 and 12, "Then the elders and all the people at the gate said, 'We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together build up the family of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore in Judah.'" So she's blessed by the people at the gate. They're married. They have a child. And Naomi now once again has a family, as God blesses her through Ruth's love and kindness and faithfulness. Verses 14 through 16. The woman said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." Then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. So Naomi is restored to having a family. And once again, she and those around her recognize that this is the work of God. In this case, working through the love and the kindness and the godly character of Ruth. And the book ends with a genealogy, telling us why this story is in here. Verse 17, "The women lived there, said, 'Naomi has a son,' and they named him Obed, and he was the father of Jesse, the father of David." So Ruth and Boaz are in fact the great-grandparents of King David, and thus also in the line of Christ. The name Obed means servant or worshiper. I think going back to the idea of how all things go back to God. He is the one that's been in charge of this from beginning to end. Then you see the genealogy there. I'm not going to try and read down through it, because I don't like trying to pronounce Hebrew names. A few things to note regarding the genealogy. In a genealogy, when you see father of, it can't just mean ancestor of. A lot of times writers of genealogies will skip over generations where nothing important happened or where no one was very well known. There's almost certainly gaps in this genealogy. The one who's listed as the father of Boaz, Salmon, or however that would be pronounced, over in Matthew 1:5, he has a very interesting wife. Anyone want to guess who his wife is? One of the few women named in the genealogies. Not Hagar. She is one of the other women. It's Rahab. So Rahab is a direct ancestor of Boaz, possibly his mother, but more likely, given the span of time between the conquest of Canaan beginning and the end of the time of Judges, she's probably a grandmother, great-grandmother, great-great-grandmother. But God pulls into his people, into his genealogy, into the line of Christ, people who you wouldn't expect. Rahab, the prostitute of Jericho, and Ruth, the Moabite, from a nation that's supposed to be excluded from God's presence. And I think one of the messages of Ruth is that God can work through someone from a bad background just as easily as someone from a godly home who trusted him in an early age. Excuse me. Two main things I think we can get from the book of Ruth beyond that is, you know, we find ourselves living in a society where more and more that everyone does what is right in their own eyes seems to be a pretty good description of the direction our society is headed. And this book comes with two big reminders for people living in that time. And the first is that we can be encouraged that God is always still at work for his glory and for our good. In this story of Ruth, he uses the sinful actions of Elimelech and his sons to draw Ruth to himself. It doesn't turn out so well for Elimelech and Mahlon and Chilion, but he uses that to draw Ruth not only to himself, but into the line of Christ. And no matter how chaotic and awful things in this world look, and you know, just turn on the news and it's pretty horrific right now, history has not spun out of control. God is still guiding all things to his appointed end, to that day when all things are made one in Christ. And we can trust him and not despair when we turn on the news. Maybe just don't even turn on the news for a while. But know that he is in charge, that he knows what he's doing, even if it looks like things are messed up and completely out of control. And the second thing is that no matter what is going on in society, we need to be godly people, even if we see fewer and fewer other godly people around us. Whether it's being like Naomi, who, once she got over her pity party, took a role of teaching and guiding Ruth, the new believer, which was something that's been sadly lacking throughout the book of Judges. As each new generation falls into apostasy, there was obviously a lack of guidance and teaching. So Naomi takes that role. Like Ruth, the hero of our story, with her commitment to God and to his people, to being a part of his people, with her willingness to learn and to work hard and to do this not just for herself, but so that she can take care of another person's needs. Because, I mean, over and over in the Bible, that's what true biblical love is. It's taking care of another person's needs, often at personal expense. And there's the example of Boaz, who had a commitment to following the law of God, even if it was going to cost him, even if it was going to cost him Ruth. He was going to do what was right. He was going to do as God's law commanded. And he was a man who showed kind treatment of an outsider in the form both of protecting her and of being incredibly generous toward her. Even before he thought he was going to marry her. Because you have to figure, probably the reason that she had to propose to him is he was not going to force himself on her. He wasn't going to be her benefactor and then have her marry him out of guilt. And Boaz even serves as a type of Christ. A type is something in the Old Testament that prefigures something in the New Testament. The Old Testament is called a type. The New Testament thing that corresponds was called the anti-type. So there's your theology terms for tonight. And most types are about Jesus. I mean, the Passover lamb is Jesus Christ. Boaz, in some ways, is a type of Christ. He's the Redeemer who takes a bride and buys back what was lost through sin. Just as Jesus buys us back out of the condemnation that comes through sin and views the church as his bride that he's going to one day take to be with him forever. And that's the book of Ruth.